You thought the immigration crisis couldn't get more bizarre? Here's Alligator Alcatraz. Here's also the last voices of the Holocaust. And here's the Stanley Cup, again. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup. I'm your host, Tim Padgett. In the next hour, we'll assess another week of immigration controversy, from Miami's vote to partner with the feds to Florida's plan to build a migrant detention center in the Everglades that's being called Alligator Alcatraz. We'll also speak to a South Florida journalist who's recording what the last surviving witnesses of the Holocaust have to tell us here today. And we'll salute our repeat Stanley Cup champs, the Florida Panthers, who've made us the hottest thing on ice. All that coming up right after the news. I'm Tim Padgett. Welcome to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Bienvenidos, bienveni, benvindo. Here's a defining reality of President Trump's epic deportation drive. In order to justify the arrests of tens of thousands of law-abiding and gainfully employed undocumented migrants, the administration believes it needs to portray all undocumented migrants as violent criminal threats, even if that's false. This week, Florida Attorney General James Uthmeyer took that campaign a step further by proposing a major high-security migrant detention facility in the Everglades that he's calling Alligator Alcatraz. It was just one of the new immigration controversies South Florida had to process this week. They included a close vote by the Miami City Commission to have local cops partner with federal immigration enforcement, which followed a heated community debate that reflected rising criticism of Trump's policies from the once loyal Cuban community. This all comes amid new polls that suggest the rest of America is also souring on the president's deportation crusade in the wake of protests in Los Angeles. We'd like to hear your latest thoughts about all this. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio to help make sense of another tumultuous week in immigration news is WLRN's government accountability reporter Joshua Ceballos. Also with us is Miami-based NBC News reporter Carmen Sassine. Josh, Carmen, how are you?
Doing well, Tim.
Good.
Josh, let's start with the city of Miami's vote this week to approve its own partnership with the Federal Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, or ICE, to assist with immigration enforcement, what's known as a 287G agreement. We've seen every Florida county and hundreds of municipalities like Hialeah and Coral Gables already approve 287G deals, but this one in the city of Miami felt especially contentious. Why was that, and why was the vote so close?
Yeah, this was some of the most community engagement that I've seen at a city of Miami commission meeting, and I've gone to quite a few. There were more than 100 people there to speak on public comment, and the vast majority were there to speak on the 287G item. There were people lining up outside. The fire marshal had to keep people outside because of fire concerns, and it was 90-degree heat, and people were waiting outside to speak against this, saying, this is a bad look for Miami. These immigration raids, they're hitting people who are, like you said, law-abiding. They have gainful employment, and people are afraid. And the fear, I think, is that now if the police department partners with ICE, people are going to be too afraid to call on the police department because they don't know.
Because this is Miami with a very large majority migrant community population.
You know, around 70% Hispanic, majority migrant city. And even business owners were saying, I don't want this because you know, my employees might be undocumented and I'm afraid to call the police because they might now deport my employees. So even on the commission, there was a lot of debate about this, and some of the commissioners made hard lines about, I'm not going to support this.
But the vote was 3-2, as we said, very close.
Yes.
And one of the reasons that it did win out was not so much fear of Trump, but of
really Uthmeyer and DeSantis.
Yeah.
You know, they're the real boogeymen here, because I think the concern from the city was that if they didn't approve this, then they would be considered under a new Florida law, a sanctuary city.
Right.
And that they could face repercussions, you know,
as we've seen with cities like Fort Myers, for example.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. And so the, I think the city attorney's counsel was that these commission members could be removed from office, or they could, the police department could lose funding. And I think that's what they were really afraid of.
Right. And we should also mention, though, that there is another city here in South Florida, South Miami, which has filed suit against the state of Florida, against Governor DeSantis, claiming that, no, we are not compelled to join a 287G agreement, as the state seems to think this new state law does demand.
Yeah, it's a weird catch-22 where the law doesn't say you are required to do this, but it says if you don't do it, then we could consider you a sanctuary city. And that was the debate on the dais was, it, you know, South Miami has a lawsuit open about this. Let's just defer until that lawsuit is done.
Right.
And they were poised to defer. It was very close.
Yeah.
But then Commissioner Joe Carollo, he spoke a lot about his own immigrant experience coming from Cuba on the Pedro Pan flights and the Venezuelans that he knows. But at the end of the day, he said, you know, based on what the city attorney is saying, I'm going to vote in favor of this. Mm-hmm. And when that happened, Miguel Gabella shifted and said, all right, I'll vote with you. And the new Commissioner Rafael Rosado also voted in favor. So it was 3-2.
That's interesting, though, that they're going to wait and see what happens with the South Miami lawsuit. I think a lot of cities all across Florida are sort of in that mindset, I guess.
Yes, they are. And the other kind of wrinkle in this is that the commission chairwoman, Christine King, was pointing out was, we're not a sanctuary city and we don't need to agree to this because Miami-Dade County is already in the 287G agreement. Miami-Dade County is top dog and they're already enforcing this. So why does the city of Miami Police Department need to do this?
Right.
But they went ahead with it anyway.
Right. So Carmen Sassine, you know, as Josh and I were just discussing, a lot of the folks, if not most of the folks who were there in this, you know, community debate at Miami City Hall were from the Latino community, Cubans, Venezuelans, et cetera. Carmen, you did a really insightful piece for NBC last week trying to make sense of these dual emotions that pro-Trump Latino communities here, like Cubans and Venezuelans, are feeling as they watch this severe immigration policies come at them in ways they did not anticipate. We've even watched some of their Republican political leaders, like Miami State Senator Ileana Garcia, who founded Latinos for Trump, or Latinas, I should say, for Trump, and Miami Congresswoman Maria Elvira Salazar, both of them Cuban Americans, turn against his deportation crusade in recent days. Garcia even called it inhumane. Carmen, what are you finding as this plays out?
That's right. So I spent some time in Hialeah speaking to Cuban American voters who supported Trump, as well as in Doral speaking to Venezuelan Americans. These are two cities that supported Trump in huge numbers. And what I found is that people are wary of the deportations going on. They agree that criminals should be taken away from the country.
Sure.
But they don't like that there are what they consider hardworking families that actually came here legally, because many of them came through the CBP One app, through the Biden, during the Biden administration, as well as the parole program that Biden had. So they didn't necessarily cross the border illegally. Mm-hmm. And so they're seeing these dramatic deportations play out on social media. There are all these videos circulating of people being detained right outside their asylum court hearing or right outside their ICE check-in. And their relatives are crying, saying, why are you handcuffing my son? Why are you handcuffing my husband? They're not criminals. And it's taking a toll on the community. It's especially hitting hard among Cuban Americans who are just not used to seeing this go on.
Right.
And this community is, at least. And so I think when you see Salazar's statements get increasingly tougher, and especially Ileana Garcia's statements, I think that's a reflection of what they are hearing from constituents who have many relatives that are being impacted by this.
Right. And we should say Maria Elvira Salazar is District 27 here in Miami, and Ileana Garcia's state Senate district is part of that area as well. Carmen, I spoke to several Latino Trump supporters at last Saturday's No Kings protest in Miami, who insisted they still back the president, even if they object to his immigration policies. Should we be surprised that they can compartmentalize those two things?
That's right. So everyone I spoke to who voiced concerns about deportations told me that they still support the president and emphasize that it's too early to say whether he's going to turn out to be a good president or they're going to regret their vote. Now, it's not the first time that Cubans and Venezuelans in particular struggle with these complicated situations. For instance, both support sanctions against their home countries, but at the same time, they don't like to see their relatives, their loved ones being impacted economically by the sanctions. So this is kind of similar in that sense. They support Trump right now, even though they're saying it's too early to say how it's going to
Right.
end, but they don't like what they're seeing as far as immigration.
Too early to tell, as you said. Okay, that's interesting. Josh Ceballos, let's turn then to the most recent hardline immigration proposal to come out of the Republican Florida Governor Ron DeSantis camp. This plan from his Attorney General, James Othmeyer, to build, quote, alligator Alcatraz, a new state-of-the-art, unescapable migrant detention facility out in the middle of the Everglades. His larger point, of course, is that because we've decided that all undocumented migrants are violent criminal menaces to society, that is, when they're not propping up whole sectors of Florida's economy, like agriculture, we need more lockups like this, he claims. Does this look likely to go online, and would it actually be Florida's largest detention facility, as we're hearing?
Well, it seems like Uthmeyer really wants to fast track this, but I mean, like Carmen was saying, even this is too early to tell. There's a few things in play. I mean, like we've seen reporting recently, ICE is kind of bleeding money. You know, they're quickly reaching the end of their budget, and I don't know where this money would come from if they would get it from if the state would use state funds to do this or federal funds. But also, there's likely to be a lot of lawsuits and a lot of legal blockades against this for various reasons, in part from civil rights groups who might think that this is inhumane, but also environmental groups, because this is the Everglades. It's
Yes,
like
good
so
point.
important to our environmental sector and so sensitive, and we're already trying to reclaim parts of the Everglades. And even if, you know, yes, this area is paved, there's an airstrip in this area that they're looking at.
Yeah.
I think. But building a facility of this size would create greater impacts on the environment in the Everglades in that area. So I could easily see groups like the Sierra Club getting in a lawsuit.
And speaking of migrant detention facilities, Josh, we also saw another Republican, Cuban-American Miami Congressman Carlos Jimenez, decide to visit the federal detention center here in Miami, where some migrant detainees are being held, after the Miami Herald reported on allegedly disturbing conditions there for them. Just briefly, Josh, what did he say he found?
Right, so Jimenez was definitely compelled to go there because of the Herald reporting on the inhumane conditions there, alleged conditions. And but Jimenez said that there was nothing he saw there that didn't make him proud to be an American. You know, he said this is a prison. This isn't supposed to be a daycare. This isn't supposed to be the Ritz-Carlton, I believe were his words.
Were his words, yeah.
Yeah, the Ritz-Carlton. It's a prison, and the conditions aren't supposed to be so cushy. But he said there was nothing he saw that was disturbing, that he saw the
Okay.
people playing games and thought it was fine.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with WLRN's Joshua Ceballos and Carmen Cecine of NBC News about another controversial week in immigration news, including plans for alligator Alcatraz. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Carmen Cecine, when we talk about this struggle to determine the facts in this uproar over deportations and migrant detentions, I want to bring up something you've also taken a look at inside the communities most affected, and that's the chronic problem of misinformation, if not disinformation, in the Spanish language media. You took an interesting look at how that's been playing out in Los Angeles amid the anti-deportation protests there. It's also a big problem here in South Florida. What did you find, and how is it affecting this whole debate?
I think we live in a world where there is constant disinformation. Now, what you see is that there's an uptick whenever there are large protests going on. You saw it during the Black Lives Matter protests in 2020. You saw it during the pro-Palestinian student protests. And now you saw it again with the Los Angeles protests. One thing they have in common is that they link the protesters to leftist movements, and specifically Cuba, Venezuela. Mexico, they feel that they say that these governments are backing the protesters or that they incited the protesters, and there's no evidence of this. And they circulate fake pictures. For instance, there was a fake picture of Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass along with Fidel Castro. And it's easy to believe that because she has a history with Cuba, she used to travel there with the Venceremos Brigade, which is a leftist group.
Right.
And she had some comments, she made some comments after Fidel Castro died that some deemed sympathetic towards him, and she was criticized for that. So it's easy to see this picture and say, oh, of course it's real. But it's not, and people have to be aware constantly that whenever there's a big story going on or there's a big protest, there's more fake news going around. And I think people have gotten better at questioning things.
In the Latino community, yeah.
Yes, definitely. And one thing to keep in mind is that there's more of this in Spanish and in other languages than there is in English, because platforms tend to take down fake content in English more than they do in Spanish and in other languages.
Right. No, very good point. Josh Ceballos, we were talking earlier about Florida Attorney General James Othmeyer's proposal for what he calls an alligator Alcatraz migrant detention facility out in the Everglades. But on a more serious note, a federal judge here in Miami held him in contempt this week over his apparent refusal to comply with her ruling to pause enforcement of a new state immigration law that makes it illegal for undocumented migrants to even enter Florida. This seems like a fairly pivotal development in this standoff between the Trump and DeSantis camps and the courts, no?
Yeah, I mean, it seems like Uthmeyer at first was complying with this order where the judge said to pause enforcement of this law. But then he said, you know what, go ahead, it doesn't matter. Continue to enforce, told the police departments, continue to enforce this law. And so now, he was held in contempt. And I think it kind of shows the brazenness and how the energizing that the Trump administration and the DeSantis camps feel against the courts, where they feel like they can just continue to do this and they have a lot of backing to do so, and sort of flouting this division of power.
But he now has to make reports to this federal judge about how the state is complying with the law at this point, right?
Right, and we'll see. I guess it remains to be seen if that happens.
Carmen Cecilia, and I also want to look at this along the lines of what looks like shifting public opinion on immigration policy in the wake of President Trump's handling of the Los Angeles protests. A federal appeals court this week ruled that the president can keep National Guard troops deployed there to protect ICE agents. But a new Reuters Ipsos poll out this week shows that his support on immigration is falling, or has fallen, to 44%. That's a big drop from the 54% we saw a week before in a CBS poll. Is it his general immigration policy, though, or is it his specific immigration methods, like deporting so many non-criminal migrants, that's turning them off? My reading might be the latter, but what's your take?
I think you're completely right, Tim. I think it is the latter. I think it's the fact that he's not so much focusing on criminals, but easier targets, which are, let's say, Venezuelans who had their temporary protected status taken away, or Cubans who had had the parole program status taken away from them. So people don't like to see those kinds of people being deported. And I think that's where you see immigration moving the needle.
Mm-hmm. Here, in fact, is what Republican Miami Congressman Carlos Jimenez had to say last weekend in an interview with CNN.
With the Biden administration, you had a wide open border causing really chaos in this country. And so you had a pendulum go all the way over here. When you release that pendulum, it goes all the way over here. And I think we need to get back to the middle.
Okay, so finally here to end things, Josh and Carmen both, I want to ask you, do you think most Americans and most South Floridians agree with Jimenez that the pendulum has swung too far the other way on immigration and they want things to come back to the middle? Josh?
Yeah, I mean, definitely hearing that from City Hall. I mean, even Miami Commissioner Miguel Gabella, he said on the dais, I'm a Republican, I support the president, but the things that we're seeing are not okay, and it's too much. And from what I'm hearing from my sources in City Hall, staff members who are many times Cuban-American or Latin-American are angry at how this vote went with the 287G agreement, because they fear things, or their family members fear, interacting with ICE and possibly having this kind of enforcement. So I think, yeah, even Republicans here are very not very happy with what's going on.
Carmen, is that the way it looks to you, that, Americans and South Floridians just maybe want the pendulum to swing back to some moderation now?
Right. So voters have consistently voiced concerns about the amount of migrants coming in, and so they want to see some control over that.
Sure.
But they specifically don't want to see people who have already been here for a couple of years, who are married and maybe even have kids, being deported.
Right. No. Good points, all. Thank you. Carmen Cecine is a Miami-based NBC News reporter. Joshua Ceballos is WLRN's government accountability reporter. Many thanks to you both.
Thank you,
Thank you
Tim.
for having me.
Still to come, preserving the memories of the last surviving witnesses to the Holocaust. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. A report this week by WLRN's morning news anchor Christine DiMattei caught our ear for several reasons. It was about an educational multimedia project called The Last Ones. It's directed by South Florida journalist Leslie Gilrubin Benita, and it records the memories of many of the last surviving witnesses of the Holocaust. That matters because, according to the social justice nonprofit The Claims Conference, half of all Holocaust survivors worldwide will pass away within the next 6 years. But Gilrubin Benita's effort is important in other, more contemporary ways. It's a reminder that we're seeing a distressing rise in anti-Semitism these days, of course. And according to Gilrubin Benita, the project's subjects want all of us here, today, to more freshly consider the lessons of the Holocaust amid the rise of the admittedly fascist-leaning populism we're seeing across the world right now. As a result, The Last Ones forms history curriculum for students starting in middle school. Do you know someone who survived the Holocaust? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now is Leslie Gilrubin Benita, coincidentally from Tel Aviv, Israel, where people are dealing with bomb strikes from Iran amid the conflict this week between the two countries. Leslie, thank you for being with us, and we, of course, hope you're safe there.
Thank you, Tim, for having me. Yeah, we're safe for now.
Okay.
You know, we never know when it strikes, but we receive the alerts on our phone. So for now, we're fine.
Before we discuss your project, could you briefly tell us what things are like there on the ground in Israel? I understand you're in a shelter, but I also understand you have decided not to avail yourself of the means of exit that Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is offering people like yourself who are stranded there. I'm referring to the ship to Cyprus and the flight to Tampa.
Yeah, so I'm here with my children, my husband and my children. And we arrived here on the 11th, and it really started that night.
Oh, wow.
The first alert. We are not all the time in shelters. We are really running into shelters when we receive these alerts on
right.
our phone.
Right.
We most of the time we have about 8 to 10 minutes to run to shelter. That's how life has been for the past, a little bit more than a week right now. So really alerts on and off and, running to shelters. I really want to take my kids out of here. Don't get me wrong. And I appreciate the effort that was done to get some of us Floridians out of here. It's just, if I'm being really, really honest, you know, land crossing in Jordan or in Egypt without any guarantee of U.S. military or government assistance on the other side, I didn't feel it was a safe, I didn't feel it was safe enough for my children. And really what I thought was, if you're going to suggest that Americans go through these, what I consider dangerous routes right now, there better be like some sort of boots on the ground or something to help us once we cross.
Okay.
So, and by the way, you know, I'm talking to you about the phone, the fact that we receive these alerts, this come from, it's these Israel's like home front command, and it's not surprising, but they're saying that these ways are not safe.
Right.
It's so I really didn't feel like I didn't feel like doing it. And trust me,
no.
I want to be safe, but I didn't feel safe enough.
No, we appreciate your assessment of that. Thanks. Now, to your project here, I should mention that you're a native of France, correct? And you are the granddaughter of four Holocaust survivors. Is that correct as well? Tell us about them, if you could.
That's correct. Yes. So I was born and raised in France, and by four Holocaust survivors. They were very, very present in my life. Four Holocaust survivors, that they were the four of them from Poland, and they had been in Poland back like more than 12 generation, at least what I could go back to. Mm-hmm. And so they really survived, which was a miracle, because Jews in Poland, like 98% of them were exterminated. They really survived, and it was like a long, it was 5 years of horrible,
yeah.
Like leaving day by day, just to know that you're going to make it the next day, mm-hmm. was a miracle already. And so in 47, so when the war ended, they were sent to DP camp. And in 47, they were sent to France. It's not a country that they were from or that they knew. They didn't even speak the language, but that's the only country they would take them in.
What,
believe it or not, their dream was to go to America.
What then were the origins of the Last Ones project? What prompted you to take on this project, and how did it take shape? I recall you mentioned to my colleague Christy Mate that a lot of this was about getting many of these survivors to break their silence about the Holocaust, or the Shoah, as it's known in Hebrew, the sort of silence that perhaps your own relatives kept about that nightmare.
That's it. Like, very often, this is what you hear from descendant of Holocaust survivors, is that, you know, they grew up with bits and pieces of stories, but really it was something that they would not talk about. It was too hard for them to talk about. And so I think that starting like the Last Ones is a way to give voice to those who never spoke, and to build also a living bridge between the last Holocaust survivors and the next generations.
So how did you go about identifying and locating these last surviving Holocaust witnesses? And how many should we expect to be included in the Last Ones project?
So far in the Last Ones project, we have more than 180.
Wow.
Testimonies. And it's funny because I'm often asked, how do you locate the first ones? And the first ones, you know, are the, some of them are the ones that I grew up surrounded with.
Uh-huh.
So not necessarily my grandparents, but friends of my grandparents. And then you start and you do one and you do another, and then you have something to show. I'm also part of another organization that's called 3G, and which stands for Third Generation Holocaust Survivors. And so I'm surrounded very often by Holocaust survivors, and I explain to them what I do, and I build the trust with them, and this is how I manage. So a lot of it started with word of mouth, and then finally we're at a stage where people call me now, and they say, you know, my aunt, my grandfather, my grandmother, they have a story to share. Can you come in and capture?
One nice human detail you mentioned in Chris's report this week was that when you visit these survivors, you hand them a lechak, a traditional Jewish honey cake. But once you're into conversation with them, what do you find are the memories and the horrors that they want to prioritize for the rest of us to know as it all comes back to them?
So, yeah, I always go with this cake, just also because I was taught never to go to someone's place without empty-handed. But I would say that really what they want to focus on is the personal stories. Okay, sometimes you learn more from the story of one that you will learn by opening a history book. So they're really sharing their feelings, what it was like for them as an 8-year-old, as a 10-year-old, as a 12-year-old, so that you can really feel, or at least start to feel, what they felt.
Right.
And other thing also that they really insist on is not just the weight of what they've gone through, but also the, you know, the lifelong process that comes after that, because it's not just, you know, let's say, you know, for those who went to concentration camps, it's not, it, you know, survival didn't end with liberation. It really was a life and is for some of them that are still there, it's still a lifelong process.
Right
So I
now.
always try to focus on moments, that show resilience and reinvention and quiet strength, because starting a family, building a career, finding small joys again after all of that, it is really impressive.
Right now,
And
that's.
this is what we're trying to show. Their life didn't stop at tragedy. They moved forward. They carried, even though they were carrying unbearable memories. And so the idea is, and they also have a great message, which is, don't be bystanders.
Right. And
Don't be bystanders.
this is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm speaking with South Florida journalist Leslie Gelrubin Benita about her education multimedia project, The Last Ones, which is preserving the memories of many of the last surviving witnesses of the Holocaust. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Leslie, we want to play an excerpt from your conversation with a Polish Holocaust survivor named Anita Karl, who today lives in Surfside. Can you give us just a very brief introduction here about her story, which we should warn our listeners is disturbing in its eventual recounting of Nazi murder?
So, Anita is a great lady. She was initially from Lviv, which is Lviv today in Ukraine. Randomly enough, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was also from Lviv, and she was taken into the ghetto into the ghetto in Lviv with along with her family,
Right.
and she made it out, but her father did not. And
And
she's unbelievable.
here is one of the more disturbing memories she conveyed to you.
One day I was sitting with a cousin of mine and playing. She was a little older than I. Probably I was 4 years old or something like that. And we're sitting on the street in this corner playing in the dust. And an officer, a Nazi officer, a German, comes by, looks at us and says, "Would you like this piece of chocolate?" We both got up and we ran to him. My cousin was faster than I, and she got there before me. He picked her up, sat her on his lap. With one hand, he gave her the chocolate, and with the other one, he took out his revolver and shot her in the head. Is this a human person?
Again, that was Holocaust survivor Anita Karl of Surfside. Leslie, I think the answer to Anita's last powerful question there is no. But obviously, the point of an educational presentation like The Last Ones is to explore how humans can become so unhuman. What is it that you and these survivors' hope stories like Anita's will convey to students and adults, not just about the horrors of the Holocaust, but its causes and its warnings?
Well, I mean, the idea is really to spark a little bit of, obviously, to spark some humanity for sure, but some empathy. Because, this started when she says, "Where was his humanity?" This started in Germany, and these young people were educated, and yet look what they were capable of doing. So my hope is that this work really helps create a world where memory is not just preserved, and that's really why so many of these survivors are testifying. They don't want the memory just to be preserved. They want this memory to be used,
Right.
okay?
Yeah.
And used to create a world with empathy, with moral clarity, and moral clarity not being just a rare quality, but something that is expected every day.
Right.
So, the idea is also for the future generations to recognize warning signs early,
Right.
so that they can act before the injustice takes root.
Right. And along those lines of future generations, just finally, then, here in the last minute we have, Leslie, why did you decide that middle school age students, like sixth graders and up, were the appropriate starting point for hearing these stories?
I guess that having children the same age when I started helped me kind of, judge whether it was too early or not. Obviously, not every video is good for a sixth grader or seventh grader. You know, what I do is like I really am mindful of which story is age appropriate. But I think, yeah, I think it's not too early to start in sixth grade. We don't have to. I'm never sugarcoating a story, but some stories are not as, let's say, as tough as the one that we just heard. And yeah, I think it's good to start early because we talk about bullying at the beginning of a story, so that starts as early as sixth grade.
South Florida journalist Leslie Gelrubin Benita directs the multimedia Holocaust Witnesses Project, The Last Ones, and you can find out more about it at lastones.org. Leslie, many thanks, and be safe.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you.
Still to come, Florida is the hottest thing on ice, baby. The Panthers are Stanley Cup champs again. This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. Welcome back to the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I admit I am not the world's biggest hockey fan. I'm a soccer fan. But last Saturday night and Tuesday night, I was not watching the Soccer Club World Cup. Like most South Florida sports fans, I was glued to the final games of the National Hockey League Stanley Cup Championship, and I watched the Florida Panthers skate all over the Edmonton Oilers to win their second straight title, back-to-back for the Cats. A hockey dynasty in subtropical South Florida might sound as unlikely as the Jamaican bobsled team, but we've embraced this hottest show on ice phenomenon as passionately as we once cheered the Dolphins, especially in Broward County, where the Panthers play at Amerant Bank Arena in Sunrise, and where the Panthers' victory parade will be held in Fort Lauderdale on Sunday. Are you a Florida Panthers fan now? Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Joining me now in the studio is one of our own big Panthers enthusiasts, WLRN's Broward County reporter Carlton Gillespie. Carlton, how you doing?
Good, Tim.
So as I mentioned, this team didn't just win the Stanley Cup again, it dominated. It won that last game by a score of 5-1. And one of the Panthers' goals that stuck out for me was the second score in the first period, a glorious slap shot by Matthew Tkachuk. Am I pronouncing that?
Tkachuk.
Tkachuk, sorry. From an even more masterful assist by Etu Lostarinen. Got that one right?
You got Lostarinen better
Thanks
than you did
very
Tkachuk.
Much. What makes the Florida Panthers so good?
Well, that's the thing, right? With a team this dominant, there's a number of issues. I mean, you can start at the goalie position. Sergei Bobrovsky, or yeah, Bob, as the fans call him.
Exactly.
It's the rare instance of a high-paid goalkeeper working out, and I'm sure you know that in soccer as well.
Yeah.
How many
No,
how
the
many
guy's a vacuum cleaner, yeah.
He's unbelievable. But also, the team is really deep. I mean, six players scored 20 points during these playoffs, and in a sport where you're rotating lines as frequently as you do in hockey, you just never get a break. And you saw that. Edmonton is a fantastic hockey team.
Yeah.
They like to skate fast and they like to counterattack, but they are just overwhelmed by the pressure that the Florida Panthers put on them and put on everybody else.
Now, in fairness, we should point out that the Panthers are not actually Florida's first National Hockey League powerhouse. Our cross-state rivals, the Tampa Bay Lightning, won two of the three Stanley Cup championships they played in between 2020 and 2022. The Panthers duplicated that feat, now having won two of the three championships it's vied for between 2023 and this year. So, of course, we got to ask, Carlton, how did Florida virtually take over the National Hockey League? And start, if you would, by reminding us just how bad the Panthers were not so long ago.
Yeah, I mean, it's not an exaggeration to say that the Panthers were the laughingstock of the National Hockey League. There are a number of stories. In a story I did recently, I got to talk to Dave Hyde, who's a Sun Sentinel sports columnist. And, you know, he told me that when Alex Ovechkin was going to be draft eligible, the year before, he missed the cutoff by 2 days. The Florida Panthers management claimed that because of leap years, that he actually met the minimum requirement and drafted Ovechkin in like the sixth or seventh round. They were so strenuous that this was the case that the league shut their microphones off during the draft so they would shut up about drafting Alex Ovechkin, who, of course, went on to score the most goals in NHL history. So there's just a number of stories like that. I mean, they were giving away tickets. I went to a number of Panthers games and sat on the glass for $20 growing up. I mean, this team was frankly destitute. Right. And that's what kind of differentiates them from the Lightning. The Lightning won a Stanley Cup in 2004. They went to the finals in 2015. They had their dominant run 3 years ago, and now the Panthers have had theirs. The Lightning have been good before.
Okay, but we're more of a worst to first story then.
Big time. And I think one of the big consternations of hockey fans across maybe North America is that no Canadian team has won a Stanley Cup since, I think it's 1993. Yeah. And Florida, a team from Florida, has appeared in the last six Stanley Cup finals.
But again, how did Florida become this hockey mecca?
Well, there's a bit of, you know, there's the cynical answer, and that is that South Florida fans are bandwagoners. And if you win, they will come. And the Panthers are certainly doing a lot of winning. But, you know, I also think that with the Dolphins being kind of the perennial 8-8 team or 9-8 now team, and the Heat kind of having crescendo downward after LeBron left, it's kind of the new thing in town. We won't mention the Marlins, but it's kind of the new thing in town, and it's an exciting sport. You know, guys are slamming into each other and skating fast. It's not something that lends itself to golf claps and polite applause.
But I get the feeling the Panthers coach, Paul Maurice, who we should mention is Canadian, he's had a lot to do with it too, no?
Yes, it's his system that the players are playing. And this team had good players for a while, but it's really Maurice that's kind of marshaled them all together. And Maurice, similarly to the Panthers, I think he's fourth in wins in hockey history, but he also has the most losses of any coach. So he's a guy who's been around a while and could never get it done, and he comes to the Panthers and delivers them their first, now two, Stanley Cup champions.
But just as important as how the team got so great, Carlton, how the team won over a region of people who don't even own ice skates, let alone know a power play from a checking penalty. You mentioned, you know, obviously we've been let down quite a bit by the franchises like the Dolphins in recent years, and we are kind of known for being fair weather fans, etc. We wait for winners. But again, how did we turn people in subtropical South Florida into, you know, Canadians?
Well, and I think that's, I mean, I was at a watch party for game six.
Right. And I want to ask you about that in a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. And then the next day I went to the Elbow Room down on Fort Lauderdale Beach, where the Stanley Cup was there, and beer was being poured into the crowd. And you could tell there was a good number of fans, and you could tell by sight and smell and sound, among other things, that did not go to sleep, that just like the team stayed up celebrating all night. Mm-hmm. They've been able to kind of whip people into this fanatical obsession. I mean, I talked to fans that have only watched hockey for 3 years, two years, you know, a matter of weeks, and something about the excitement of the sport, the way this team specifically plays, and the way these players talk about the team and talk about each other, I think is something that's really endearing, and people have picked up on it.
This is the South Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tim Padgett. I'm talking with WLRN's Carlton Gillespie about South Florida's new sports dynasty, our own Stanley Cup repeat champs, the Florida Panthers, and how they've, well, put ice in our veins. Call us at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-9576. Now, Carlton, I want to stay on this question of how a region of Miami Dolphins, Marlins, and Heat fans became Panthers hockey enthusiasts. Now, as you mentioned, you watched one of the Stanley Cup games between the Panthers and the Edmonton Oilers at the Funky Buddha Brewery in Oakland Park. What struck you about the self-described hardcore Panthers hockey fans you found there, but also how they became hardcore hockey fans?
Well, I think this has been it's a great opportunity for fans who have been around since the beginning, and they aren't the majority anymore, but they've all certainly come out of the woodwork with their old school, the old logo, the old style jerseys that they've maybe had in their closets for 10 or 15 years to say, you know, hey, I've always been here. I've always been a fan.
You described one guy who made sure he got there about an hour and a half early just to make sure he could get a good table.
No? Yeah. Christian was his name, and he went and sat at a few tables to try try and figure out, you know, okay, when people show up, let's do this, you know, but it's the same thing at the Iceplex, the Panthers practice facility. I was there for game six. There was a 40-minute wait to get in at about 8 o'clock because they were over capacity. I mean, there were 7,000 to 8,000 people at one watch party for a team that, like I said, 5 years ago was a joke.
And one question I have is how many of these people are Broward County folks and how many are Miami-Dade? Because I think there's this feeling that, well, Broward has always felt like a, you know, a stepchild when it comes to sports franchises here. So that may be one of the reasons they've, you know, taken to the Panthers so much. It's a way of sort of thumbing their noses at the Miami-Dade crowd.
And that's absolutely true. It's much easier for folks in Broward to get to the Amerant Bank Arena than it is to get to the Kaseya Center, for instance, for the Miami Heat. Mm-hmm. You know, but at the same time, there is a good contingent of fans that come from Miami because they can just take, 75 up to the Sawgrass Expressway, and they're right there at the stadium. So they're kind of in a really great position there to get fans from all over.
Now, one of the things I keep hearing is what a great vibe it is to attend a Panthers game at Amerant Bank Arena. What's it like?
Yeah, live hockey is a singularly incredible experience for a sports fan. It has all of the intricate passing and build-up play you might recognize as a soccer fan with the kind of serious physicality of a football game. It's fast, it's loud, it's just something that's like that's very difficult to take your eyes off of, and it's one of those things that is great on TV but unmatchable live.
And do you find that a lot of the new fans that they've really learned the game itself, like I was mentioning before, what's a power play, why is it so important, that kind of thing?
That's one of the things that's so striking at these watch parties is, you know, you think it's just they're just going to cheer when the goal goes in, but you wouldn't believe applause breaks out when the puck clears the blue line on a power play.
And remind our listeners what a power play is in hockey.
So a power play is if you commit a penalty, one of your players will leave the ice and you'll have to play a man
down. He's got to go to the penalty box.
The way hockey works is you have your offensive zone. There's a blue line that represents the border. And if the puck leaves that blue line, all of the attacking players have to get out. Mm-hmm. So if you're defending on a power play, you're a man down, you get it past the blue line, you've relieved the pressure for at least a few seconds there. Yeah. And there's fans applauding that. I mean, that is something that's unthinkable to just the casual hockey fan or just to anyone who knew what the Panthers were like just 5-10 years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of an exciting moment when a power play develops, right?
Right. I mean, for both, right? It's a great opportunity for you to score, and you're really sticking it to the other team when you don't let them get there. I think that's one thing that makes hockey so exciting. And you maybe know this as a soccer fan. How many times have you seen a player on the other team do something that you think is dirty or something that, you know, he's just putting your defenders in a blender? Wouldn't it be nice if the other players on the team could just go hit him and not get a yellow card? I think it's something that's just very appealing to
soccer
fans.
Players aren't wearing shoulder pads, though. So in the minute we have left here, Carl, how good is this team? If they can keep the unit together, what do experts think are the Panthers' chances for a three-peat next year?
They're the best team in hockey. I think that's been unequivocally proven. There are a few key contributors that they'll need to resign. Number one is Brad Marchand, who came over at the trade deadline. Mm-hmm. He was stellar, probably the runner-up to the final Stanley Cup Finals MVP. And the other is Sam Bennett, who was the MVP of the Stanley Cup Finals. Now, I will say, and this is reporting I can do because I was at Elbow Room, maybe Bennett was not in his right mind. There was a lot of beer involved, but he was chanting 8 more years with the fans in allusion to a contract that he's been offered. So maybe Sam Bennett is signing. Maybe he's just letting the fans have it in the celebration.
Okay, and finally, remind us when and where Sunday's Panthers Victory Parade will take place in Fort Lauderdale.
That'll be on Fort Lauderdale Beach. It'll start at about noon at Rio Mar Street. They'll head south down to Fort Lauderdale Beach Park, and they'll have kind of a rally there at about 1:30. Parking will be impossible. They're saying please take ride shares, water taxi, you know, Uber. Downtown parking will only be $10. Uber down there. Anything you can do to avoid parking on Fort Lauderdale Beach, it'll be a nightmare.
Carlton Gillespie is WLRN's Broward County reporter. Carlton, thanks as always.
Thanks, Tim.
Finally on the roundup, whenever elected officials make some sort of questionable, controversial, or downright stupid decision, we can often rely on artists to call them out on it. If you can't beat them, mock them. That's the rallying cry from one Miami-based theater company. WLRN's Christine DiMattei has details.
City Theater is going up this month with a scaled-down version of its popular Summer Shorts Festival. It usually runs for about 3 weeks, offering theatergoers a mix of short-form plays, monologues, and musicals. But this year, City Theater was forced to cut the festival down to just 4 shows. Last year, Governor Ron DeSantis vetoed all $32 million in state arts and culture grants, and City Theater got hit pretty hard. Nonetheless, the company is promising that Summer Shorts will be a loud and funny response to getting defunded. Here's City Theater Artistic Director Margaret Ledford.
We gravitated towards joy because to be joyful in diversity, to be joyful in resistance and resilience, that is truly the opposite of oppression.
City Theater's Summer Shorts Festival runs from Thursday, June 26th to Sunday, June 29th at the Sandrell Rivers Theater. I'm Christine DiMatte in Miami.
That will do it for the South Florida Roundup. If you missed any part of the show, you can always search for the South Florida Roundup podcast in the NPR app or wherever you listen to podcasts. The show is produced by Jimena Romero with assistance from Denise Royal. Katie Munoz is our director of original live programming. Mateo Sanchez is digital director. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's vice president of news. The vice president of radio and the show's technical supervisor is Peter J. Mertz. MJ Smith engineered today's show. I'm Tim Padgett. Have a great weekend, and thanks for listening. Gracias, merci, obrigado.
WLRN.